Go ahead and get started. Reconvene from our break. The next item on our agenda this morning is an overview of the proposed northern spotted owl critical habitat designation by Ken Berg of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Good morning, Ken. I'm going to have you introduce yourself for the record here in a moment, but I just want to explain why Ken is here this morning. We did send out a note to all the board members regarding the Fish and Wildlife Service announcement of the draft critical habitat rule. And we've been talking about owls for off and on for a long time at this board, and I wanted to remind the board that when the federal critical habitat rule is finalized, the board has a period of time after that with which to evaluate whether the board's rule for state critical habitat needs to be modified. So currently, I believe the final federal rule designation is due out just a few days after our November board meeting. And so we'll see how that timeline either stays or changes and what the board's responsibility will be after that. But the board does have a responsibility to act once the federal critical habitat rule is finalized. So we'll be seeing that, we'll have a conversation about that later. And with that, if you could introduce yourself and take it from there.
Good morning. Thank you, Bridget. My name is Ken Berg. I'm the Washington State Supervisor for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for Ecological Services, which includes the Endangered Species Act. And thank you for inviting me here today to give this presentation on two things. One is our proposed revision to the spotted owl critical habitat range-wide, and the other is the concurrent release of a draft EIS for experimental barred owl control, which is another important piece of our revised recovery plan for spotted owl. So in the 2011 recovery plan, which we finalized last summer, we identified the main threats to spotted owl recovery being habitat loss and competition from encroaching barred owls. And in March of this year, we announced two policy proposals concurrently to show that we're taking a holistic and balanced approach to those two threats. And both of those proposals are out for a 90-day review. One of those is the proposed revision to spotted owl critical habitat range-wide, and the other is a draft environmental impact statement to contemplate doing some experimental removals of barred owls. We will be extending the comment period on the critical habitat proposal later this month with the release of a draft economic analysis on the economic impacts of the critical habitat. And so that will reopen or extend the comment period for the spotted owl critical habitat revision. And that comment period, when it's extended, will be for the entire proposed rule, including the draft economic analysis. And then we expect to finalize the critical habitat by November 15th of this year. And we expect to finalize the barred owl EIS in early next year. And if we make a decision to go forward with experimental removals, those might start in 2013, and the earliest we could assess their effectiveness would be in 2016. So we rolled these two proposals out simultaneously to reinforce that we're trying to do both in a balanced way. The recovery strategy that we put into our revised recovery plan is to protect the best remaining habitat, to actively manage forests, restore their health and resilience, and to reduce the harmful impacts of barred owls. Both proposals were polarizing and controversial. There are reactions to the fact that we added more acres into the proposed critical habitat, and that we have guidance saying that we want to do some ecological forestry, but we think that ecological forestry is compatible with spotted owl recovery if it's done in the right places in the right way. And then it's been controversial to suggest that we would be removing barred owls through lethal control to try to give the spotted owls a chance to more effectively compete in the same area.
Ken, are you going to describe what ecological management means?
Yeah, I will. So in the recovery plan, we let science lead the way. One of the reasons we went back and did the recovery plan over and got a remand from the court on critical habitat was that the Inspector General found that we had undue influence from policy of political leaders in the Department of the Interior. The last time we did the recovery plan, that was the foundation for the Spot L critical habitat revision. So we went to the court at the beginning of this administration and said, we want to do that over. And we also got some pretty strong criticisms from some mainstream scientific groups that we had not fully looked at the habitat issue across all ownerships. So in the revised recovery plan, we said we would go back and redo the critical habitat with a look at the best habitat across all ownerships, not just federal ownerships. And that's what this proposed critical habitat revision is based upon. We used some other refined, sort of state-of-the-art remote sensing and modeling tools to identify the best habitat. We are supporting active forest management and restore forest health, particularly on the east side, where insect and other forest structure issues are making those spot owl habitats prone to catastrophic fire. And in some areas, even on the west side, ecological forestry can enhance lake successional characteristics of forest, commercial thinning and other means to speed up lake forest successional characteristics that are important to BARDAS. So it's a matter of where, how, at what point in the time continuum of the forest coming back can intervention actually improve the area for spotted owls or prevent those areas from being lost catastrophically. So it's a risk management issue, some short-term risks for some longer-term benefits. And then we will refine both proposals after receiving public comment, scientific peer review, and looking at the economic impacts of the critical habitat designation. And when the Endangered Species Act says that when we list a species, we cannot consider the economic impacts. But it says that when we propose critical habitat, we are to look at the economic impact of the critical habitat designation alone. So that's a really important point, and many people are disappointed by our economic analyses because we are to look at just the increment that the critical habitat regulation has an economic impact, not the economic impact that the listing itself had. And when we propose critical habitat where the species occurs and it's already occupied by the species, or was at the time of the listing, then a lot of what might be perceived as economic impact came with the listing of the species, not this increment of the new proposed federal regulation. It's called an incremental economic analysis. And so it tends to point out less economic impact than people perceive because much of that impact came from activities that came with the listing. So I'm just keying that up because when you see the draft economic impact analysis, it's really important to know that. It will be explained, the document will be long, and that might be missed if you don't sort of understand the premise for the analysis.
Bridget, can I ask a
clarifying
question on that?
Go right ahead. So maybe if in the case of what you're just speaking of, that incremental, and now that we're looking at a change in critical habitat from what that may have been, would that economic impact be only then on the change?
That's a good question. It will be on the impact of the whole designation, on the all the acres where they are, not just the difference between the last one and the new one.
Thank you.
So this is the process and objectives we use to identify the areas that we have proposed in the revised critical habitat. We want to ensure sufficient habitat to support healthy populations of the spotted owl across the range. We broke the range into 11 different modeling units, which then are portrayed in the proposed critical habitat as critical habitat units. We want to ensure distribution of populations across the range of habitat conditions, from the north, the Canadian border, down to Northern California, from the moist west side forest to the drier east side, to the mixed conifer in the Klamath region. So there are a number of different habitat types that the spotted owl occurs in. So we tried to ensure distribution across that range of habitat conditions. We need to incorporate uncertainty from the effects of barred owl, climate change, wildfire, and disturbance risk. And we recognize that critical habitat protections are meant to work in concert with other recovery actions, such as experimental removal of bardos. So these are the numbers in the revised proposal. There's a total of 13.9 million acres proposed across the range from Washington, Oregon to California. By state, there's about 4.8 million acres in Washington, about 5.1 million in Oregon, and about 4 million in California. The majority of the land proposed for critical habitat is on the U.S. Forest Service, National Forests, 9.5 million acres. 1.5 million acres are in the BLM lands, primarily in Oregon, and then about 1 million acres are in national parks. Across the range, 670,000 acres of state lands have been proposed, and then across the range, 1.3 million acres of private lands have been proposed. We also propose to exclude from the final designation all the areas that are covered under habitat conservation plans or safe harbor agreements, which are private lands that have entered into conservation plans with us, have an Endangered Species Act permit under Section 10. They tend to be multi-decadal agreements to manage in ways that are compatible with sustaining owls and also having timber management.
Or so, public.
Thank you. Non-federal lands, thank you. And the DNR State Trust lands is also a major HCP that we're proposing to exclude from the plan.
Yes, ma'am.
Ken, will you get to, or do you have the specific numbers just for Washington State, even though I know your provinces kind of overlap?
Yeah, so thank you, Dave.
Yes.
The acreage changes between the proposed and final, between the last final and this proposed revision are summarized by, it is larger overall. And one reason it's larger overall is we are putting in on the front end congressionally reserved lands, which are national wilderness areas, the forests and then the parks, and national parks. This is the third time we've done spotted owl critical habitat. If you follow the history, we have treated these congressionally reserved lands different ways, so they add significantly to the total acreage. This time we put them in on the front end, and we are taking comment on whether we should include them in the final designation or not. In the last two final designations, we did not include these congressionally reserved lands for policy reasons. Not that they're not important for spotted owl recovery, but we didn't feel they needed an additional federal regulation to achieve the management necessary there. So even if something doesn't end up in the final designation, it doesn't mean it's not important for recovery. It just means that we decided that those areas didn't need another federal regulation, and the Secretary of the Interior can use balancing to remove certain areas for economic or other relevant impacts. And one of the relevant impacts we have used for 10 or 15 years is impacts to conservation partnerships that develop plans that we think are good for managing the habitat for those species, and that the addition of another federal regulation on top of those lands that have a plan with us could be perceived or is perceived by that landowner as an impact to that partnership and the implementation of that partnership. So, for example, using the state trust lands in Washington or a multitude of HCPs we have, those entities came in to work with us to develop a long-term conservation agreement for those lands. There's nothing in the ESA that says they have to do that. The ESA says they just need a permit if they're going to take a listed species. They have come in, shared data on where endangered species are on their lands, including species that might be listed in the future. But that are currently listed. They have negotiated long-term agreements that may work for decades. And we believe that that partnership that led to them coming in and working with us, agreeing to a multi-decadal plan that protects even not listed species, species that might become listed in the future or might not, is really more beneficial to conservation to develop the plan and to continue to implement the plan than another federal regulation where the species is already protected by a prohibition against take. So that's the policy principle by which the Endangered Species Act allows the Secretary of Interior to weigh the benefits of designating on those lands, weighs the benefits of excluding, and when the benefits of excluding outweigh the benefits of including, and it won't lead to the extinction of the species. Secretary has broad discretion in not including those areas of critical habitat. Even if they don't get finally designated, they've still been identified in the front end and through the recovery planning process as important to the recovery of the species. So the second bullet there, state and private lands, range-wise is about 2 million acres. That's consistent with the recovery plan direction to go look at all the high-quality habitat, irrespective of whether it's on federal ownership or not. All the private lands that we have identified in the state of Washington are inside the spotted owl special emphasis areas that are regulated under forest practices. Not all of the spotted owl special emphasis areas lands were identified, but the high quality habitat within there. That's about 180,000 acres. About a quarter of those lands already have safe harbor agreements or habitat conservation plans with us, and we're proposing to exclude that portion of those private lands that are in, are under those agreements inside those SOCEs. And we're also taking broad public comment about whether we should exclude all private lands. Range-wide. Majority of the land is again on federal land, Forest Service. It includes some matrix lands. Those are the lands that are not inside the Lake Successional Reserves. That's consistent with the recovery plan direction to look at all the best habitat. And many of those areas, particularly in Oregon, are subject to litigation anyway because there's a lot of social issues around harvesting old growth, whether or not it's spotted owl habitat. And so some of that area has not really been accessible, critically to the BLM in Oregon. And then we removed about 2 million acres of Lake Successional Reserve that isn't functioning as habitat. You know, it's maybe too high elevation, it's not the right forest type, and so we didn't want to have the acreages inflated just by including all the Lake Successional Reserves, which is one of the acres differences. It's actually brought the acres down since we don't see those as high quality spotted owl habitat. So our goal is to have a critical habitat designation that's scientifically defensible, legally defensible, supports overall management goals of the Forest Service BLM states as much as possible, enables a variety of timber management when consistent with spotted owl recovery, and we provide guidelines for timber harvest compatible with recovery goals using ecological forestry. One of the things that we have done over the last couple of years is we've worked on some pilot projects, particularly in the Coast Range and mixed conifer areas of Oregon BLM, to try to show some of these ecological forestry principles. We used Norm Johnson and Jerry Franklin to help design some of those. The BLM put out some pilot sales. They were bid on. In fact, some of them were bid higher than the BLM thought they would be bid upon. And they've been implemented, and now we're monitoring to see how well those work to enhance spotted owl recovery. So we're trying to be clear that we don't think that locking all this land up and not managing it is appropriate for recovery. It's about what's the health of that forest, what's the state of succession, can active forest management improve spotted owl recovery, or is it past that point and then really active management is not compatible with spotted owl recovery. So a little bit about the modeling effort. It was range-wide. The first step was to model and map habitat quality. Then we designed a different potential habitat conservation network scenarios and tested that against persistence of the spotted owl. And I'll go into that in a little bit of detail. The first step, we used this model, MaxSamp, along with remote sensing data to map the relative habitat quality range-wide in these, in these 11 different modeling units. The second step was to aggregate that high-quality habitat into blocks. And the third step was to test the effectiveness of different potential reserve scenarios, potential critical habitat designations, against long-term persistence of owls. And we also tried to, in the modeling environment, control for barred owls, because at some point, at a high enough barred owl encounter rate, some of which we are experiencing through the demographic modeling in the north part of the range, you can't tease out the effect of habitat. The barred owl effect swamps out persistence of spotted owl. So we had to, in the modeling environment, dial down the barred owl encounter rate below what is actually occurring in some of these modeling areas. And that is predicated on the idea that we're trying to see if we can also complete the CIS to do some Bardell control experiments. Without dialing down the Bardell encounter rate, all the habitat that's available wouldn't show a difference in spotted owl persistence. So that's why we modeled that way. And then we took a number of possible habitat scenarios and modeled against long-term persistence. So on the vertical axis, that's the number of female owls out in the future in the model at year 350. And then the bars there are different composite scenarios of habitat, high-quality habitat that came out of that zonation model in step two. And the first bar right here is the existing Northwest Forest Plan, 16.39 million acres. And then we used a number of different composite scenarios to test the persistence of female spotted owls over time in the model out to year 350. And we wanted to find the most efficient land allocation that would have an acceptable level of spotted owl persistence out into the future. And Comp 7 is what we have proposed for critical habitat. So some larger habitat scenarios had higher persistence. Here's one that was almost the same number of acres, but that had lower persistence. So we tried to keep running these until we found something that we thought was an acceptable level of persistence, but also had the most efficient landscape.
Ken, so is this modeling that it's based on a reduction in the barred owls, though?
In some of the zones, yes.
So, okay.
In some, particularly in the north, particularly in Washington, the barred owl invasion is going from north to south. It's more, it's further along, more severe in the north.
So if you're unable to do that with the barred owls, then you don't get the habitat improvement benefits?
Right. You can't tease out what different habitat scenarios improve spotted owl persistence.
Right. You get the habitat, but you don't get the owls.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And this is just another way to look at the models. You know, that was looking at number of females over time. This is looking at when you run a bunch of simulations in the modeling environment, how many times, sort of up here, how many times do the simulations get to a low level of owl persistence? And smaller numbers are better over here, 12, 3, 1. This scenario, about the same number of acres roughly, had higher levels where the number of females in the modeling environment came down. This is range-wide. These numbers are range-wide in the three states. So this is just another way of looking at, you know, is there going to be a bottleneck under this scenario and where you get to, there's a high probability that the spotted owls are going to reach a low level that might, you know, teeter on them not persisting over time. These are range-wide numbers, not by critical habitat unit. So these are the maps that are in the Federal Register notice. The left is all of the 13.9 million acres, and the right is we depicted what would the final designation look like if we excluded all the congressionally reserved areas, the National Forest and National Park Wilderness, and the congressionally designated national parks, if we excluded all the areas that are under habitat conservation plans and safe harbor agreements. And so the right map, this light blue, is what would be excluded from the final designation if all of the congressionally reserved parks and wilderness and the habitat conservation plans, you can see some blue down here, these are the DNR trust land, were excluded from the final designation. Yeah, I'd like to move on to the barred owl draft EIS. We have a clear obligation to do whatever we can to prevent extinction or recover the spotted owl, even if it's controversial or experimental. The barred owl has a competitive advantage. It's more generalized in its food and habitat requirements. It can use younger and more variable forests. It's more aggressive, strongly defends its territory, produces more young, and lives at a higher density in the forest than the spotted owls do. Our goal for the experiments, should we decide to conduct them after the EIS process is complete, is to test the effectiveness and feasibility of RDAL removal as a management tool. It is not to conduct wide-scale control program. It's to do some scientifically credible experiments to see if this could be done. And we worked with a broad stakeholder group, hired an ethicist, brought in a bunch of folks over a year or two to see at what point would the public potentially accept these experiments. And we've incorporated that learning from what the public and social values are into the design of these experiments. So we want to be effective in improving the demographics of spotted owls, how many young they're producing, how many of them there are in the habitat. We want to manage barred owl densities. We'd like to be able to maintain lower barred owl densities. And with strong habitat protections in place, we believe there's a good chance of success in recovering in the long term if we can manage the barred owl problem in the short term. So in the draft EIS, we have a number of alternatives, including a no action, don't do any experiments alternative. The alternatives vary on methods of removal and combinations of lethal, non-lethal, the different locations, the duration, the cost, and the number of barred owls removed. Again, we tried to bring in stakeholders to see under what circumstances might they allow us to try this. And generally it was, if you do it as a science experiment before you move to any program, and you are, you know, as thoughtful and ethical as you can be about how you do it, then most of the folks said they would be willing to not challenge the experiment. We didn't get them to sign on the dotted line, but it was good feedback. And then we did a lot of outreach with folks because it is highly controversial, and it's going to be challenging to even do the experiments. So there are a variety of alternatives. They're spelled out more in detail in the EIS. We had a public meeting last week up in Seattle. A number of people came to us, kind of a workshop format. We could go into this in more detail. There are some areas in Washington and the various alternatives. Generally are these different long-term study areas where we've been doing demographic studies. It's really important to have baseline information so that we can detect a change from the experiment. So the first two alternatives have areas in Washington. Alternative four also has an area down in southeast part of the range in Washington. This is in the Cowlitz Valley, and alternative four, again up in the Olympics, and alternative six, and then a variety of areas in Washington and throughout the range, alternative seven. So I just wanted to give you a broad overview of that so you could also be informed about that if the board or individuals wanted to comment on the draft EIS.
Thank you for that. I'm sure there'll be questions. Yes, Norm.
Is there a preferred alternative?
There is not at this time.
Ken, can you describe for us, I've had folks talk to me a little bit about the relative roles of the recovery plan that was released a few years back and then critical habitat. And I heard you say that critical habitat sort of is a federal regulation, so a recovery plan is advisory, sort of what you as a service believe is what is needed to recover the species, but then critical habitat becomes where you feel you must put a rule in place to protect that. So can maybe for the board's education help us understand what we should be looking to when we're thinking about how we look at spotted owls in Washington. Does one have more weight? Is one a subset of the other? That would be helpful.
Yeah, that's great. So I would say one is a subset of the other. Critical habitat is a subset of the areas that are important to owl recovery. And we spelled this out in the front end of every critical habitat rule in one, saying it's not a park or wilderness or a hands-off area, but two, it's not all the areas necessary for recovery of the owl. It's It is a subset of those areas where we think an additional federal regulation is important to ensure primarily that federal agencies, who when they consult with us, also look at whether they're adversely modifying critical habitat. Now, one of the reasons there's such a small incremental economic analysis is federal agencies are already consulting with us when the species is there, and we're consulting on the effects of habitat modification on the species. To have another layer in that consultation about whether you're adversely modifying critical habitat such that that area can't support owl recovery at the critical habitat unit scale, one of those level modeling region scales, which there's about three in Washington, isn't really much different than what we're already doing when we consult with federal agencies. So technically, critical habitat in a regulatory context is strictly for federal actions, federal land, federal permits, federally funded activities. Now, Congress also intended that critical habitat has an educational effect because it can inform others, including this board, of areas that are important for owl recovery so that other entities, this board, local governments, et cetera, can use their own authorities to better protect the owl. But a lot of that educational benefit has happened throughout the years of particularly in the case of spotted owl. This isn't the first time we've talked about owl recovery, or we've done things in the state of Washington for owl recovery. So a lot of that educational benefit has already accrued, whether or not sometimes even through the process it is accrued. And so it isn't necessarily additive in the final designation, because this board already, particularly in the case of this effort, the private lands we identified are already in spotted owl special access areas. Now, that doesn't mean that there's nothing that this board might want to consider, and you have your own rules about what you need to do at the end of the final designation. So I just want to be clear, it's not all the areas that are important for owl recovery. For example, if we exclude the habitat conservation plan areas, we're not saying those aren't important for owl recovery. We're just saying we don't think we need another federal regulation to have federal agencies consult with us on those areas. In that case, we're often the federal agency involved. Well, we had to consult with ourselves on issuance of that permit, and so we've already done that. And so I don't want people to be confused that if it's not critical habitat, it's not important for the owl. In fact, in the recovery plan, we have Recovery Action 18 that's specific to Washington, and working with this board and its spotted owl implementation team to identify areas that of non-federal land in Washington that can contribute to owl recovery. So there's more explanation of that in the front end of the critical habitat proposal.
That's helpful, and that's an important distinction that I wanted to make sure the board all understood.
Maybe just to illustrate that a little bit, or maybe stimulate some more discussion. The zonation maps that you all came out with in the modeling exercise, so step two of the modeling exercise, there's some nice bright colored blobs of habitat that spill out, say, south of federal lands in the peninsula or various places in the Cascades that aren't in SOCES. So that modeling exercise at least identified areas of high quality habitat that was concentrated enough to provide some sort of benefit, but those areas aren't in the critical habitat rule. So just by way of illustration, there's some science out there that says there's some other places where habitat exists today where there might be a contribution that aren't in critical habitat, nor are they covered by our current rule package. So that's just something to throw out there, think about maybe for future discussion.
And the recovery plan has a number of recovery actions that should be seen as working together to protect high-quality habitat irrespective of the land ownership, and also to incentivize non-federal landowners to encourage spotted owl recovery and spotted owl habitat management. And also tells us to try to work with landowners to develop agreements, habitat conservation plan, safe harbor agreements. Now, Washington has a number of those already in place that were developed during the 90s. And so a lot of that a lot of work has been done there. There could still be more work to be done there, particularly to encourage, to remove the disincentives, let's say, for people to promote owl habitat.
Norm.
Could you describe, at least conceptually, because I'm sure the specifics aren't there yet, how a barred owl experimental control area that's in an area that includes federal Forest Service lands as well as national park lands and maybe some other private lands might be coordinated? Are there differences based on what the underlying landowner is as to how that experiment may be carried out?
Yeah, we're going to need the cooperation of any landowner to do these experiments. And so we've been having conversations with the federal land managers. One of the reasons we had the only workshop we've had on the STRAP DIS up in Seattle is the Park Service wanted us to have one up in Seattle, because they some of their parks are identified as possible study areas. So you're right, the details haven't been worked out, but we're going to need the cooperation of any landowner to undertake an experiment on their land. And that's why we're going through the CIS process, to look at the effect of on the human environment, take public comment, make sure that folks understand the goals, and we try to design it in a way that can be acceptable to the landowners and to the public.
So put another way, the experimental design is not necessarily beholden to a property line.
No, it's not.
Thank you.
Ken, you talked about the inclusion of private lands and how that was different. Could you maybe talk just a little bit about that, sort of the rationale behind it, so that the board is aware of that distinction in this designation versus previous ones? And sort of why you ended up going that way.
Sorry, could you repeat the first part of that question?
You had mentioned that you included private lands for the first time and that was controversial. And so I'm just curious, for the board's sort of education, why is that new, why is it controversial, and sort of what led you guys to do that?
Okay, great, thanks. Mm-hmm. So in the first time we did critical habitat, we did propose some private lands. We didn't include them in the file. The recovery plan and the scientific criticisms we got in the last recovery plan identified that we should look at the high quality habitat irrespective of land ownership. So we did that range wide, and the modeling takes off the land ownership layer, just looks at what's out there now, what the model tells us is most important to owls, where the blocks of that are. And I think because in Washington, the spotted owl special emphasis areas were identified and designed in the 90s to complement the federal lands. They tend to be situated in good locations to block up and supplement what's on the federal lands, mostly National Forest in Washington. And because those areas have been regulated and managed, that's where a lot of the highest quality habitat on non-federal lands currently exists. So it really wasn't a coincidence that the areas we identify as most important to spotted owl recovery are in the spotted owl emphasis areas. I think that's sort of a product of what's been going on in Washington since the spotted owl special emphasis areas were designated. From a policy perspective, it was desirable to me to integrate with what's going on already in Washington, and to let the science lead the way. But if we had an acceptable level of owl persistence in the modeling environment in the top seven, and didn't need to go outside the spotted owl emphasis areas, then for me that was a good place to stop. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, just you. Most of it. The last piece was just that it was you commented that in your comment period, you're seeking comment on the inclusion or exclusion of private lands, and that it had been quite controversial. So I just, for the board's knowledge, I just wanted to get, just sort of make sure they were aware of that, and I took from that that you've been hearing quite a bit about that inclusion of private land and how that's not the norm, but in Washington that was done in a way that recognizes the existing framework. And so
well, that's good. Let me just clarify that some more. It's controversial every time we that, no matter what the land ownership is. So it's all degrees of controversy. Okay. It's not unusual that we designate or propose to designate private lands. I've worked on, you know, a dozen or more private designations, and most of them have some private lands in them. So it's completely within the realm of what we have the authority to do, and often do. I think it's given the amount of public land for the owl, it tends to be a minority of the areas. But in this case, we decided it was essential and important to include some of them. More of them are in California, but it's always controversial whenever we include anybody's land. I mean, the Forest Service and BLM aren't really happy about that either. But it's even more controversial when you go off the federal lands, and you know, anyone whose land shows up in the Federal Register, it's a big impact to them, whether or not our economic analysis can tease that out. The reason that we're seeking public comment on a range of options for final designation is we just wanted to be very thorough about that, and the scenario that I described about economic or other relevant impacts, the other relevant impact to a conservation partnership, and the scenario I described where you have an agreement with someone and the agreement was a result of a partnership and their desire to implement that agreement is part of an ongoing partnership and they may perceive another regulation on top as an impact. I'd say that's on one end of the continuum of having a pretty, in my view, a robust argument for excluding that area. Along that continuum is also any private lands that are designated. That landowner may also perceive that as an impact to a potential conservation partnership. So we're kind of taking comment on that whole continuum of other relevant impacts. I would say over the last 10 years, for legal sufficiency reasons, we have tended to need to be more robust in that weighing analysis. And but there will be arguments made that even though I don't have an agreement, it's an impact, and it will dissuade me from having a partnership and agreement. And we wanted to hear people out on that issue, too.
That's helpful.
And for clarification, if I remember the slide, that it showed 180,000 acres of private, 25% of that is covered by NHCP. So on this grand scale of the millions of acres, it's, at least in Washington, pretty small. Is that what that slide was?
Yes, it is. Now, to those landowners, it might be.
I'm not dismissing.
No, yes.
I just wanted to understand the scale.
Yes, the private lands in Washington that are proposed for designation that don't have agreements and therefore are not explicitly being proposed for exclusion are about 150,000 acres. They're all inside the SOCES. And the total proposed designation without any exclusions is about 13.9 million acres. So it is relatively small. There's a much larger proportion of the private land total in California. There's no private land in Oregon that's proposed. There are some state lands proposed in Oregon that don't have conservation plans on them.
Yes, Paul. Do you know if there are, within the SOCES, if there's acres of proposed designated critical habitat that are outside of actual owl surveys?
I believe there are.
And maybe one last question. You mentioned that you're going to extend the comment period once the economic analysis comes out. For those that are generating comments in the audience, I'm sure that was they're keenly interested in what that extension time period would be.
Yes.
Do you know what that would be? We
are working to try to get the economic analysis draft mm-hmm. finalized and cleared for review. Our goal is that near the end of this month, we will release that, we'll have a press release, and we will extend the comment period for 30 days on the entire proposed rule.
Okay.
That's our goal. Okay. We're pedaling as fast as we can.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Yes, David.
So just a quick question, and Ken, I don't know if you can answer this, and maybe some of the board members like Norm or others can help. Because critical habitat is it on the ground, and I don't want to minimize this either, so if I miss quote, so on the ground, critical habitat in theory doesn't affect private lands unless there's a federal nexus, correct? If there's a federal action or funding or something like that.
It doesn't directly.
From the federal perspective, it doesn't affect private landowners. I always.
Unless
there's that nexus.
Well, right? this board takes action as a result of that action.
And I would just call that an indirect because it's not directly coming from the feds. So what all I'm trying to get at is maybe a little bit better understanding about how often there is a federal nexus on private lands, especially industrial forest landscapes, because I don't really have a good feel for that. So it's a question about does that occur very frequently and what's the magnitude?
Yeah, so I don't have an exact answer for that, but the vast majority of times where there is that nexus, we're already consulting on the presence of the species and the effect of habitat disturbance on the presence of the species. So we're not really proposing in the critical habitat unoccupied areas. Under the law it says areas where the species occurred at the time of listing or other areas such that they're essential for the recovery. We believe that all the areas that we are proposing are areas that were occupied by us at the time of listing. So we're already consulting with the federal nexus on the presence of owls, habitat disturbance on the owls. So that's where you're probably going to see in this economic analysis that there's not a lot of incremental economic impact, because that a lot of that, the vast majority of that came with the listing. And that's where it's going to be unsatisfying for some people, because it's all down here and it's not in that increment.
Thank you. Yes, we're getting behind schedule, so I'll try to keep us moving along. Go ahead.
Yeah, just to illustrate to David's question, a common one that we run into is the use of a road that may be on Forest Service or National Park property, at least in our area, and that is that federal nexus. So we would run into that issue, and it's probably more common than you might think.
Great. Other questions? Ken? Well, thank you, and I do want to thank you that I note in both the recovery plan and I don't recall if it's exactly in the critical habitat, but there is clearly usually a recognition of the work that the state of Washington has done for owls, and I would expect that you running the Washington office have a large hand in that, and I want to thank you for that, because this board and this state has done quite a bit for protection and recovery of owls, and it's always appreciated when that is appreciated. So so thank you for that.
Thank
and thanks for coming today. Before we close off this topic, though, I did want to talk with the board. Staff and I were in preparation for this, and in preparation for the final designation in November, we've contemplated in the past possibly a subcommittee of this board preparing itself for that final designation. And what our proposal would be is possibly in August to have maybe a larger segment on the agenda for maybe a more robust briefing for all the board members. We've had quite a turnover in board members on what the current state is. So we talked about the spotted owl special emphasis areas, or the SOCEs. Maybe we thought we'd walk through where those are, what rules apply to those, how those were designated, talk about our spotted owl implementation team and what they're working on the voluntary incentive side. And then maybe bring back this, the maps of where critical habitat is, and seek volunteers from the board to participate on a subcommittee to prepare ourselves for when this designation is finalized, so that in November or subsequent to that, we have a few folks essentially working on this already, and it doesn't kind of catch us, because we only have a defined period of time. And staff, could you remind me how much time the board has after a designation is made?
The time limit isn't on the board, it's on staff to provide a recommendation to the board.
Lovely. So that affects me both ways. So, but other way, so 30 days, did you say?
Yes.
So the staff have 30 days to brief the board. Currently, the designation is set to go final 2 days after our board meeting in November. We contemplated moving or suggesting to move the board meeting. However, we quickly get into Thanksgiving and other holidays, and no disrespect to your service, but timelines do move sometimes, and whether legally or otherwise. And so so just knowing that those timelines are out there, there is not a recommendation to move the board meeting at this time. But we will be seeking those within the board and a subset, so that we don't hit a quorum, to possibly participate in a subcommittee.
Just a quick question to Ken. With a probable 30-day extension on the draft, does that have any implications on the November 15th final?
Not at this time. Well, it has a lot of implications, but
right.
Not on the deadline.
Right. Yeah, for the rest of the folks, that's a court mandated deadline at this time, so you need to seek relief for that. Great. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here. That was very informative. Appreciate it. Okay, moving along, we have our adaptive management. The next item is adaptive management lean process update, and Jim Hotvedt and David Howe, our consultants, are here. Appreciate your patience with us going a little bit behind on schedule. Over on schedule. Welcome. If you could introduce yourselves, please, that would be great.
Well, I'm Jim Hotvedt, and I'm your Adaptive Management Program Administrator, and with me is David Howe of Strategica. And to remind the board of how we got where we are, I'm sure you can hear me. I don't know about them.
Well, TBW is on today,
I'm
and
sorry.
So if you could speak into the microphone,
that'd
be
assist. Is that in the November meeting, the Force Practice Board, you folks, asked the Adaptive Management Program to conduct a lean event on an adaptive Management Program process. And based on advice from the new Department of Enterprise Services, they suggested, because of the complexity of the program, where we have a board, we have policy, we have CEMER, each of those has its various processes, it was suggested that we do first an opportunity assessment to decide where we can get the most value added. And David, Strategica, was the contractor that helped us get through that opportunity assessment. And if you recall, I reported on that at the February board meeting. So where we are today is that we've actually had a lean event the last couple months, and we're here to report on the results of that. And so now I'll turn it over to David.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you could introduce yourself, please.
Okay. I actually have a slide up here that will help to do that. I realize we're behind schedule, and I've got about 5 or 6 pages here. Are we going to...
You'll be fine. We have ways of making that up.
We can make it up later. Okay. I'll skip some of the boards to move along a little bit. But here's a list of all the wonderful things that I've done over the time. As you can see, I've been consulting since the mid-'80s and doing these types of projects, lean projects, since 1988. They didn't call it lean back then. They used other names like TQM and business process redesign. And these methodologies have been evolving over the centuries. And the current iteration is called lean process improvement. I've been working with Washington State agencies since 1994. Actually, the first project I did was a lean project for the Employment Security Department back in the mid-90s, and been doing work for the state ever since. King County is also a big client of mine, LA County, state of Oregon, so anywhere that Alaska Airlines flies. There we go. This project, the first thing we did in this project was to determine what objectives we wanted to achieve with Lean. There are a lot of different things you can do with Lean process redesign, and we sort of narrowed it down to two that seemed the most compelling to the CEMER group. The first one was to reduce the cycle times that it takes to process rule changes. And the cycle time being the elapsed time from when you identify that you have a project you want to take on until you complete the project. And just thought that the cycle times currently are way too long, and that there's possibly quite a few work activities that take too long and don't really add a lot of value given the amount of time that it does take. So they wanted to reduce cycle times. The other main objective, which is kind of related to the first one, is to eliminate any non-value-adding work. In other words, work that they do that doesn't really add any value to the ultimate customer or the ultimate outcome of the process. A little bit about lean process transformation. It was something that was actually started in the manufacturing world in Japan. The car manufacturers in Japan sort of took the existing process redesign methodologies like the TQM and the Deming methods and adapted them even further for these manufacturers. That would have been, say, the late 80s and the 1990s. And then later in the decade, these techniques were then further adapted for service industries and eventually got around to government agencies as well. So, and in the last few years, I've seen a marked increase in interest in lean techniques and public sector entities. It's a technique that emphasizes eliminating non-value-adding work or processes, kind of just getting to what the core outcomes you want and how do you get to those core outcomes and eliminate anything that doesn't get to those core valued outcomes. It also emphasizes setting quantitative performance targets and benchmarks, which is something different from what the previous process redesign methodologies had. Lean is much more oriented towards quantifying what it is you want to achieve and making sure that you nail it. And later on, you'll see that we've tried to quantify the CEMER rulemaking process as much as possible. The last bullet, I'm not going to describe all these different techniques. There's a lot of different techniques in Lean, but it involves limiting the use of paper documents, limiting work queues and downtime, streamlining rules and policies, and so on. There's just an example of what's involved with Lean. The process, after we identified what objectives we wanted to achieve, we set about trying to break down the whole CEMER rulemaking process into its constituent pieces, and then identifying which pieces would be most advantageous for using a lean techniques. The criteria that we used for selecting these constituent processes were trying to find pieces that support the lean vision of the agency. Also, we want to make sure that it's really a process. This actually hangs up a lot of agencies where they want to improve something, and it turns out it's not really a work process. It's could be just a set of activities that they undergo, but it's every time they do it, it's different. It's not really sequential or orderly. It's more like a creative process. And I think there were some aspects of what CEMER goes through that didn't really fall into that category of being a real work process. We kind of skipped over that and went to the ones that were work processes. We wanted to make sure that we were going to redesign something. It was something that the organization could actually control. In other words, it wasn't in the hands of contractors or stakeholders. And they're going to do it the way they want to do it. So we want to make sure it's something we can control. We want to make sure that it's something that can be implemented timely, where the performance is measurable, so we know if we're getting better or worse. We want to be able to make sure we can measure that. And also something that the stakeholders would be interested in, stakeholders being your board and other key groups, offices, what have you. So we use this criteria to look at these constituent process elements, and two of them just rose right to the top. First one was the scoping paper, and second one was the study design. So we decided to apply the lead techniques to those two sub-processes of the CEMER process. What we did, we first we mapped out the current work processes for scoping paper and study design, and looked at them real hard to try to figure out what it is that's causing long cycle times or resulting in lots of non-value-added work, and how do we get rid of that. We redesigned the processes using those various lean techniques and mapped out the proposed processes. And I should, this is one quantitative measure. I believe the page count for the process maps or the value stream maps that we produced, I think for the total page count for the current process was about 13 or 14 pages of boxes and arrows and decision points and what have you. We got it down to 3 pages. So there's one quantitative measure right here as to how we're able to use techniques to eliminate a lot of work steps. Some of the key features of the redesign processes are fewer review and approval steps. They're still there, just fewer of them. More reliance on small teams of qualified writers that work more independently, and these teams have less structure and a little bit less due process than the current groups that are involved in these processes. Fewer input, comments, and decision points for the SEMR. The SEMR still gets their chance to weigh in and give a thumbs up or thumbs down on where this is going, but there are fewer decision points for SEMR. An expedited peer review for projects with less potential for rule change or that don't delve into, or that delve into areas that aren't so unfamiliar to the state or the adaptive management program. For those types of projects, they could go into an expedited peer review process. And we actually identified what that expedited peer review process would be and the criteria that you would use. And then the final bullet there is that it seems kind of obvious, but this is a little bit, quite a bit different process, and it should be piloted with one or two projects first before it's generalized across the adaptive management program. And we actually did identify two potential pilot projects going forward. I mentioned earlier that in Lean, you like to quantify things. So here's some measures that we came up with to show where we were and where we want to be, or where we think we'll be. Comparing the as-is or the current process to the proposed or the quote to be process, the as-is process had 74 months of cycle time to get through this coping paper and study design. That's kind of on the high end, but based on looking at each constituent step, I actually think that's pretty accurate. It had 9 separate do loops totaling 16 iterations. In other words, when I say do loop, it's where we get into an approval point, and if we go thumbs down on something, then we go back to revise it and send it back to the group that's going to approve it and give a thumbs up or thumbs down. Sometimes this happens 2-3 times. So if you add up all these approval loops and the number of iterations that it goes through, it's quite daunting. There were 12 different approval points for 5 separate documents like study designs and response matrices and what have you. So that's what the current process looks like. And if we're successful in implementing the proposed process, we'll get it down to about 15 months in cycle time, so an 80% reduction in time. Instead of 9 separate approval or do loops, we've got it down to 3. There's still 5 documents that we're looking at, but there's far fewer approval points for looking at those documents. And just as an aside, we like to throw in a little caveat here. This really assumes that we're going to get the appropriate scientific and technical expertise to populate these what we call TWIGs, or technical writing implementation groups, which are kind of going to take the place of the SAGs. A little bit different composition, a little bit different mission for these groups and how they operate in their procedures, but this is one of the key caveats that we want to throw out there. These people need to be available. Finally, just some observations, global observations on the AMP structure. These are things that sort of fell out of the scope of work for looking at the process of how we do study design scoping papers, but thought I'd throw them out there anyways. One is that the distinction between the SEMR and the policy group is, in my mind, a little bit fuzzy. And if you have the same people on both groups, and quite often they're the same people that speak in both groups. And as a lean consultant, one of the things that always raised my radar is duplication of effort. And so that sort of jumped out at me. I've only been working with this group for a few months, so maybe there's more to it than I see, but I think that's something that ought to be looked at in the future. Lots of due process, and I think we were successful in reducing some of the less valuable or necessary due process in scoping papers and study designs, but there's a lot more to the ANP than just those two constituent pieces, so I would encourage the ANP to look at what other due process is out there, and do we really need it all. Finally, CEMA operates on a consensus, and policy groups as well, operate on a consensus voting model where they need everybody to give thumbs up, or I guess they can thumb sideways and abstain, to move projects forward. And this is what results in a lot of the long cycle times and the do loops and the iterations and what have you. And my question, again, out of scope for me at this time, but something to think about is, do we actually need full consensus? Can we have super majorities or a little bit different voting models to move things forward? I've actually worked with other regulatory boards and bodies that deal with natural resource conservation or land use regulation, and I've actually never seen a full consensus voting model before. Usually it's, you know, two-thirds or fifth majority or something like that. So that was the first thing that jumped out at me. I thought, why are we doing this? But anyways, food for thought.
We asked, we wanted the contractor to do a review of process and to run a lean in that, but we also actually asked him to do, you know, while he was doing the lead events, to just sort of observe and make general comments. And that's why he brought these up.
Yeah, apologize for speaking out of turn.
Your observations are helpful.
Okay.
Was that your last slide?
That's it.
Okay,
that's,
I'm sure there are questions. Yeah, David.
Just a quick question on your last observation there about the long cycle times and the consensus voting process. With the revisions, if the pilot were to actually take shape and kind of move forward on a formal basis, would those revisions negate your concern or your observation about the long cycle times due to the consensus format?
They would for the first two constituent processes of the ANP, the scoping paper and study design. But beyond that, there's the actual doing the study, drafting a final report, and there's a peer review process, and there's the finalizing the report. So there's several more months or even years of process that happens after that. And I would imagine, I didn't actually map all that out, but I'm going to assume that there's probably some additional consensus voting and due process in those steps as well. So we will negate it for the first part of this, or the ANP, but that's the last part.
So just a reminder maybe for some of the new board members, one of the things that we had been looking for was an outside audit of our adaptive management program. And at one time, the state auditor's office had been given, had been directed to audit this program, a performance audit, at our request. And that was in the auditor's budget or work plan, and then scratched, and then in, and then scratched, and then finally permanently scratched. And so we sought this alternative approach by using the lean analysis. So just for context for some of our new board members, the intent was to help us be as efficient with this program, because it is it's the vehicle to move the science through our adaptive management program and bring those results to us. And we have been hearing how long and slow that is. And also, it is very expensive the way it operates. And whenever we go to the legislature and ask them to help us fund something, they say, well, is it running as efficiently as possible? And we didn't have the best answer for that. So this is a different approach to addressing similar previous approach. So maybe just some foundation. Other questions? Yes. Well, no, I have more comments, but go ahead.
Well, in manufacturing, I'm a little bit familiar with the lean process and the Deming process. Well, what I want to know is how far down the workforce ladder did you go to collect your data? Or would you go?
Would I go? Mm-hmm. This process primarily happens at a sort of a policymaking level or a scientific review level. It doesn't really get into, say, the line manufacturing or I don't really think there are any line type staff involved in the rulemaking process, but we got right to the bottom of the workforce, which is the SEMR itself, the ones that are involved with that. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah, but in any other environment, you would typically actually do things like job shadowing, and if your transaction count is high enough, you could do some statistical analysis to look at get some empirical evidence on cycle times for each part of the process, start stop times, that sort of thing. So I'm familiar with those types of techniques. I don't know that they really apply to this context, though.
Could you go back one slide?
Sure.
It shows the accomplishments. That's really amazing, from 74 months to 15 months. Jim, are there other processes that are that could have that kind of gain on them?
Gain?
Yeah.
David talked about do loops. We have a lot of times that a decision goes to either the SAG or the SEMR, and there's a thumbs down. It's a thumbs down, it ends up going back to the SAG, or possibly even a tag. It goes back to a technical advisory group, smaller group. If it goes back to a tag, it's got to get approved there. Then it goes up to the SAG, and it has to get approved there. If it doesn't get approved there, it goes back to the tag. It could go back then there to the SAG and get approved, go to SEMR, and SEMR still may say thumbs down. It goes back to the tag. You get my point? So,
painfully. Well, these groups set their own time frames.
And so what this does is basically eliminates quite a few of those decision points. And so instead what we would be doing, what we would be recommending to SEMR is that, for example, let's start with a tag. That the tag, a small group, would put together, let's say, a draft. It would then go to the SAG. The SAG would have one opportunity for input and comment, which would go to the tag, they'd do their revision, and then it would skip the SAG and immediately go to SEMR. So basically, we'll try to minimize the number of do loops. Try to minimize it to one, basically. And so once you do that, you've eliminated a lot of time. And
yes.
Well, and the other, here's the other issue, and here's, close to being unresolvable. I'm going to use UPSAG. UPSAG meets the first week of the month. And SEMR meets the last week.
Spell out what UPSAG is.
UPSAG is the Uplands Scientific Advisory Group. More the geologists, the geology on stable slopes. So because the SAG meets at the beginning of the month, they could make a decision. But then to go to SEMR for a decision is almost a whole month later. So you've lost a month. And then if SEMR, does this and it goes back to the SAG, then they have to work on it some more. So every time you go through these do loops, you lose a lot of time just because of when the different groups meet. And so the idea being, the more of these do loops, you eliminate quite a bit of time to save. Is that?
Well, I mean, that explains those processes. I just wonder if there's another process that looks really fruitful for this sort of analysis and maybe saving time on as well.
I'm not sure I get the question.
Well, so it's study design and...
Other processes?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. So once we have the study design done, then we go ahead and implement study design. Usually it's field work. When that's done, then there's data analysis and report writing. So you have the tag doing, doing the data analysis and writing the report. You've got to have the SAG approval, you've got to have SEMR approval, and you can end up going through that whole process. The type of analysis, the results of the analysis, what the results mean, what they don't mean, just the editorial comment of the report itself. Lots of doodles. Okay, now we go to peer review. Once we do finally get a draft approved, it goes to peer review. comes back from independent peer review, and of course they what they do is they develop a response matrix, is what David alluded to. And the response matrix is, okay, the independent peer reviewer said this. How are we going to respond to that? And they put the responses in a matrix so that everybody can see how we're going to respond. That's another approval document, which can go through loops before it's finally approved. Once that's done, then that goes to the writers to revise their final reports. So that takes some time, but when it comes back, you've got the do loops on, do we approve the report? Do we approve the nuances and what's said and what's not said? So yes. The answer is yes.
So maybe a follow-up to that, and I know there are other board members that want to ask questions. Can we use what we learned from this process in other parts, or do we have to go through a whole lean event for all of those as well, or can we extrapolate to other portions of the process to gain these same types of efficiencies to get there?
My personal belief is yes, that we could. Whether we got there or not, I don't know. I think if we got there, we wouldn't need to do the facilitated approach. But I think there, what's happened here is there's a lot of advantage to having an independent facilitator take us through this. Whether it was a lean process or some other process improvement program, I think just having the facilitator there, independent, not making decisions. What's that? Whip-crackers, right? Pretty amazing how much we got done in a few meetings.
Okay. Any questions? Let's start at the end and make our way around. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
How does CMER feel about the recommendations you're making for these process improvements?
Okay, CMER. The people that comprised the group that went through this process were CMER voting members. Now, not all CMER voting members were there, but a majority were there for at least one of the three meetings. That's a good sign. And so, optimistically, I think that they will really seriously consider adopting the proposal, with some tweaks, obviously, but because, again, we only did this in three meetings. And the to-be was done in two meetings of 3 hours each, something like that. So optimistically, I think they'll adopt something, or at least try to pilot something, two or three projects, and see how they work out.
If I could just follow up on that answer, I want to also acknowledge the contributions of the CMER group to this project. Whenever I undertake a lean-type project, I'm always a little curious as to how bold these people will be and how much they're going to bite off on. The CMER group was outstanding as far as their ability to understand this lean process and what it could accomplish, and really excelled at being bold and innovative. It's getting from 74 months to 15 months and really improving this process. They're a good group to work with.
Thank you for that.
Thanks for that last answer. I was interested as to what essentially the stakeholders would feel about the reforms that you've talked about, and I know that we all appreciate improvements in efficiency, but the delays and the questions and the concerns and the no votes and the yes votes have come from every constituent group that's represented in the process. So I guess as long as they're on board to make these changes, that's probably a very good thing. I was also curious as to the, you mentioned two pilot projects that would be potentially utilizing this process. Can you identify what those are?
Is it Eastman?
I can take a guess, but I won't.
Unstable slopes criteria project and the type N east side project and forest wetlands project.
Yeah, so to be more specific, we're currently conducting a systematic literature review for forested wetlands. And one of the things that we hope to come out of that are what functions and what hypotheses should we have for a wetlands effectiveness study. That's that one. And then there's the East Side Type N effectiveness study that is currently underway, actually, development of the study design. And then there used to be a project called Accuracy and Bias. Associated with UPSAG and landslides. And the policy made a decision last year that rather than an accuracy and bias study, they wanted to actually look at the criteria that are used to define the rule identified landslides and try to determine whether or not those rules, whether we needed new ones or whether the rules needed to be tweaked. And that's what we mean by the criteria study.
At least to pick the easy ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So it would seem that that you, and you mentioned it in your last slide that consensus would in fact still be potentially the biggest bottleneck. And so you can improve and speed up a process, but until you can achieve consensus, how do you speed up consensus?
I think it's a factor of the voting model that you have and the structure of the group. Well, just to give an example, I work with a group down in California called the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, and they wrestle with the same kind of issues with regards to land use issues in the Tahoe Basin. And if I recall, it was a simple majority to make little changes. And sometimes they end up in court, but oftentimes they get adopted. So by adopting a different voting model,
I'm more talking about it among our existing paradigm, which is requires consensus. I mean, could we potentially not realize any of those benefits because we can't get to consensus?
And you have the potential of increasing the number of iterations,
right?
If you rely on consensus voting model. And you mentioned it's required, I mean, based on your policy. So whenever you implement a lean project, you have to look at not only the process, but what goes into that process, the people that are involved, the kind of systems you use, and the policies and the laws that govern the process. And those have to be looked at as well. So I would encourage you to look at those to the extent that you have control over.
Thank you.
I had a similar concern about not realizing all those efficiencies because we just create a bigger to-do with less internal redundancy. But the twigs, that assumption about the technical expertise, mm-hmm. Is that, we're going to talk about that and how likely are we to hit that and meet that assumption?
Currently, we use the SAGs, the Scientific Advisory Groups, to develop scoping papers and study designs. Sometimes those get delegated out to an individual, for example, senior staff. But often they're basically done by a committee, and the committees can be fairly large. So what you have is a study of a scoping document or a study designed by committee. That takes a lot of time. The idea here is to limit the number of people with a pen to three or four, no more than four, I would think. The idea being that if there's fewer people with a pen involved in writing something, it won't take as long than if you have five or six or seven or eight people all trying to develop the same topic. So there's been an article on faith here that having a smaller writing community will do a lot better than a larger writing.
What about the expertise part of that,
though? That'll be an issue of making sure that we have the right people. If it's a riparian area, do we have riparian ecologists? If it's in stream, do we have fish ecologists? If it's unstable slope related, do we have geologists? So it'll be critical to have the right people on the team, representative.
So one of the things that I heard from you is that you have a proposal or a recommendation that we pilot this on these three studies. And I would like to have a discussion amongst the board that I think it would benefit the program for the board to provide guidance to CMR to do that and not give it to CMER to decide if they want to do it at this time. I appreciate their boldness and, you know, great attitude going into it, and these savings look fantastic. I'd like to try it and see if it works, and see if perhaps the board could provide that direction.
You're asking for consensus.
Or, as it turns out, it's not a consensus model.
Just to be clear now, so yeah. CMER is not, CMER has, to me, I think there's a little bit of a timing issue maybe, that CMER hasn't seen this. And so CMER, in a sense, isn't making any proposals to policy or to the board yet. So this would be something you'd be directing CMER to do without CMER having even seen the report yet. So I guess what I was going to offer up before for next steps was to give CMER a shot. David still has a final report to write. We have a CMER meeting at the end of the month that he's giving a presentation to on the results. And after that, there'll be a discussion in CMER about, okay, next steps. And I guess my recommendation would be that you give CMER the next couple of months to see where they go, and then report back to you, which means in August, at the August meeting. And at that time, maybe if we haven't proceeded very far, then have some kind of a recommendation.
So would
from
any
the board.
I appreciate that, and I would want CMER to have an opportunity to at least hear and digest the information as well, in case there's something that wasn't quite right. But would any of those three studies, would any of that work begin prior to that, to our August board meeting, so that if we asked if they had the opportunity to receive the material, digest it, et cetera, and come back in August with a recommendation, would we have lost an opportunity on any of those next three studies, which I assume are the three you're talking about, to implement this new process?
We wouldn't have lost the opportunity on the wetlands because it hasn't started and it won't start for a few months.
Okay.
And that's because of the timing of the literature review. The other two are somewhat underway. Depending upon the outcome at CMER and kind of next steps that CMER would like to take, I don't see any reason why CMER couldn't form one of these twigs or two of these twigs and proceed
before August.
Before August. From where we're at.
And I think that sounds like a good plan to me, because I too am concerned about the assumptions for the twigs. And so testing that prior to August would seem to be beneficial, so that we could know, at least in those particular projects, if that's an issue. And if it is, how big an issue, and how might we get by that?
Yeah. Discussion amongst the board. Board like to provide that direction to CMER to receive the report, digest it, and then for projects that would commence prior to our next board meeting, to provide guidance that they initiate this process as outlined, and then bring back in August any recommendations for other approaches or feedback on how that's going. I see a lot of nodding. Okay.
All right. Consensus.
Consensus.
We don't need a consensus there.
One other question, perhaps, that I've had a number of folks ask me, and I think I understand the answer to it, which is we chose to look at CMER and not policy. And my understanding is that part of that choice was because CMER has prescribed processes and policy does not. If we chose to do something with policy, do you see that lean as a tool would be effective in that, or does that not? Does it not? Is it sort of the wrong tool for the wrong job?
That's a complicated answer. I think lean has elements that could help. You can improve almost any business activity, whether it's a real work process or not. It's just what kind of tool to use. I think policy could be enhanced, assuming you sort of define what it is you want done, or what your objectives are in enhancing the policy activity, whether it's reducing cycle time or making it cheaper on a unit cost basis or whatever it is. And then figure out which tools you need to accomplish those objectives. And there are all kinds of tools out there, including lean. medieval, which I use in my work. So I guess the answer is yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Complicated, yes.
Thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions or comments? Great. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you making the time to be here today. Okay. Moving on our agenda, the next item is compliance monitoring. I'd like to go ahead with that, but recognize that we'll likely push the Clean Water Act assurances till after lunch. Mark, is that a problem?
That's fine.
Okay. So let's go ahead with compliance monitoring biennial report. Walt and Darren, please join us. And Patricia, could you please make sure that you share the presentations, both the lean presentation and the spotted owl presentation, with the board, or whether you normally share them with everybody? Thank you. Now, easy to tell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning again. So, three meaty topics in a row.
Yes.
It's turning out to be a good board meeting. Walt's going to do a kind of a high-level overview of the results that are in the report in your packet. A little time for Q&A on that, and then I've got some follow-up related to the action plan that Chairman Rand mentioned this morning.
Good morning, Walt.
Good morning, Chair and Board. I'm presenting the results of the compliance monitoring report kind of in an abbreviated fashion, just going through the high points with the there we go. 2010-2011, and just starting, going to convey that this sample was a sample of FPAs that were approved from August 2008 through July 2010. So the period that this sample, the period of FPAs that this sample occurred essentially prior to the publication of the last report. So if anything was found in the last report is, you know, will not be affecting anything that occurred in this sample. But the sample from the previous report would be good findings there. So we have, we looked at 8967 applications statewide, and of those, that was in this pool, and there were 196 that were selected statewide from a target of about 200. Generally, there were more observed in Western Washington due to the higher proportion of activities that occur in Western Washington. There were 280 riparian prescriptions reviewed, 109 road construction or abandonment prescriptions, and 47 haulers were evaluated in 2011, not 2010. So the stream of the wetland typing emphasis sample was done in 2011. This was instituted to follow up and clarify some of the documentation of water types that were observed in the last report. We reviewed type NP and NS and undesignated waters to see if they were really classified as well as what the compliance monitoring review team thought they should be based on the rules. So when we looked at on FPAs that were approved between June 1 and 2:30 and September 30th of last year, compared the FPA type with the water wetland physical characteristics observed by the review team, and we looked at 55 type of waters or wetlands that were reviewed on 37 FPAs. So going back to the standard sample, we're looking here at the different categories of prescriptions that were reviewed. The no entry inner zone, which was essentially the applicant left the entire RMZ, or the applicant stayed but were leaving the entire RMZ untouched. That was at 64%, the no entry inner zone was the inner zone was untouched, but the outer zone was harvested. That was at 64%. Also at 64% was the no entry RMZ, where the entire RMZ was stated on the application not to be harvested in. DFC option ones were at 43%, option twos were at 60%, and type in S's compliance rate was 90%, the type in P's were at 82%. In eastern Washington, the no entry inner zone was at 78% compliance. The no entry RMZ for the entire RMZ was left was at 67%. The type in S's were 100% compliant, as were the NPs. Statewide, the wetlands were 95% compliant.
Can I ask you a question again?
Yeah.
So, on your previous slide from our public comment this morning, I'm assuming, Pete, that this is the table that you used to get the 83% average across those, but and I'm wondering if, no?
It's table two.
Okay, well, I can hold my question then, but I guess I'm kind of, I'm curious about the combination of compliance rates. So we clearly have higher compliance here on non-fish-bearing streams.
Yes.
And the first two, the no entry and the inner zone, and the two DFC options, I mean, is there an appropriate lumping of compliance rates that would help us describe these results, you know, a little more broadly, rather than lumping them, where we might be lumping fish-bearing and non-fish-bearing streams? That would be helpful for people to describe.
I am not, personally, lumping has some problems in it, because when we're doing compliance monitoring, we're only looking at road activities and activities that affect type waters. So there are many other forest practice prescriptions out there that the whole program hasn't even looked at yet. And so lumping these gives the impression that this is for statewide all FPAs. I'm not at a point where I'm comfortable with lumping, and I just think that the categories should be maintained for a longer period. I would be okay with lumping things like type F features, or lumping type the rest of the riparian. I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
So we looked at the road construction and abandonment. The small oak forest landowners at the 60% compliant, but it only had a sample size of 5. The industrial landowners were at 88% compliance. 57 of those were observed, with a total percent compliance of 85% and a grand total of 62. Now, there's a question about this morning, and the framers of this sample were operational in their outlook. And so when they looked at all roads, it seemed very massive to go out and sample them all. So they said, essentially, just look, determine those that we really need to look at that are have potential to delivery. And then there's this other set of roads that we call high and dry that don't have potential to deliver. And in the outset of the program, that was the way that the sampling was done. So those are separated in the sample. For this upcoming year, we take a different sampling strategy altogether, and essentially any road that gets picked in the selection process will get sampled, whether it is high or dry, or whether it has potential to deliver. So this only looks at those with potential to deliver.
Samples are based on trying to extrapolate these different categories of landowners. Is there any opportunity to suggest how much the landscape is compliant? So for the industrial landowners, 88% compliance, we're talking about a lot of land there.
Correct.
Versus the smalls, is there a way to characterize the, I don't know, whether it be miles of roads or, you know, other.
If you're using an approximation, I'm just being an approximation, since we randomly select the FPAs, this is probably at a reasonable, you know, somewhere near reasonable proportions, but it's not, you know, a precise, persistent statistical estimate of the proportion of a small landowner's land holdings to the major landowner.
Excuse me. Yes. How do these numbers compare to past reviews?
That's in the last slide of the program. I'll be happy to to carry that on there. Okay. As when we run across the, when the compliance monitoring team runs across the activities that are not compliant or the prescriptions that are not compliant, we typically categorize our level of severity. And we have a major severity, which is there's really evident or high potential impact, such as the harvest of RNG in a core zone, or cover fill slopes that are visibly contributing volumes of sediment to tight water. The moderate ones, there's apparent or potentially longer term impact to public resources, such as the complete removal of the outer zone RNG trees, or significant understocking of leaf trees in the inner zone. Undersized culverts, cut and fill slopes with the small but visible, you can tell what's going on by just ocularly looking at it. Those really are considered moderate in severity. The minor ones, these are ones with impacts of short duration over a small area, such as a few trees harvested in core in or out of those, or evidence of small amounts of sediment being being supplied perennial type perennial waters. There's also a category of indeterminate. That means the team didn't have enough information when they're out at the site to determine whether the severity level, what the severity level really was.
I just wanted to clarify that. When I was reading it, I read indeterminate maybe used in more than one meaning. But so here, there is a compliance or a non-compliance problem, but you just aren't sure of the rating.
At the level of it.
Just a quick kind of a question and comment on the severity ratings. I guess a kind of an overall observation is that they focus on not necessarily deviations from the rules in terms of how many trees were cut that weren't supposed to be or whatever it is. And it's more focused on resource impacts. And so I guess that's one observation and possible question is that the right metric or how was that arrived at?
No, it's arrived at, you know, what was supposed to be left and what was left. We're not making an assumption about what the, I mean, if the, whatever the contribution of outer zone trees is, if they're all cut, we're gonna give that a moderate rating, okay?
I guess I'm seeing it just in you know minor impacts of short duration. So we're talking about impacts, not like the magnitude of deviation from the rules. I guess that's I'm making those distinctions.
I think that's a good point.
I don't know if that's appropriate or not.
I think that's a good point. It's actually both. There's an assumption about impacts based on the degree of deviation.
Okay.
That's how we do it in the field. And it, maybe it's not as sharp as it could be in these descriptions, but that's actually how it's applied out on the ground.
Okay, and that, I guess that's kind of where I'm getting to is that I think it's important for, and I know it's very difficult, but for everybody to have kind of the same view of these severity rankings and kind of what the report means in terms of not only just the nuts and bolts percentage of non-compliance or compliance, but what it means on the ground and kind of how you got there. The other question kind of related to that, if you could go back one slide, is that it's not clear to me, or and maybe I'm not alone, but when I read under moderate where it says significant understocking of leaf trees in the inner zone, those kinds of words kind of conjure up a major effect rather than a moderate or maybe a minor. And so I know it's complex, but maybe some additional clarity around the definitions and how they're applied would help.
Yes, these definitions have been in place for a while. We've used them. We are looking at to revise them and make them clearer. But one of the features about this is that we typically get consensus among the WFW participants, ecology participants, tribal participants, on individual activity management plans. So though it seems a little vague here, there's typically a very good agreement among the field staff to review these to get these.
I just wanted to mention that. That's what I've heard as well, that it's working quite well on the ground, that these discussions as to where this stuff fits. So I think what Dave is talking about is how we interpret it and learn from that.
Right. Okay. And I've heard that as well. That's a good point, and I appreciate it.
You're always welcome to join. That's the best way to see how these things play out in the field, is to go out and actually see it. The words on the page are one thing. And we're going to continue to work on sharpening these and refining how we describe them, not only in the general terms, but also the individual specific instances. But there's no replacement for seeing it on the ground.
Thank you.
So, looking at the Western Washington All Type F, this is a compilation of those that were in the report, all type Fs. We see that there were 57% compliant, 4% exceeds, and exceeds means that there's essentially a 20% buffer larger than required left on these. 27% of these were indeterminate non-compliance, and indeterminate typically, the way we look at indeterminate is you can't, I'm sorry, I misspoke. These were minor non-compliance. The colors aren't clear on this. Minor non-compliance is something that an experienced observer has to measure with an instrument to determine typically what these are. It's not immediately obvious to the eye of the observer. So 27% of those were minor non-compliance. 1% of major non-compliance, and 4% of moderate. It's clearly the sample size is a reasonable size, but the portions certainly aren't where we want to see them.
Minor non-compliance. So are you saying they're semi-compliant? I mean,
Here's an example.
It is non-compliant.
Right.
It's not compliant according to the rule. The rule says you can't cut any trees in Arizona. We found, when I went out on recently, there was one tree cut 10 feet inside the inner zone. It had been leaning out of the unit. It was a danger tree. The logger forgot, probably forgot and yarded it up there. But never mind. So, in technicality, it's not technically compliant, but there were 1,000 other trees there, and there was one gone. Yeah.
It's a descriptor for the non-compliant ones. It's a subset thereof.
Right.
If I could ask you, I know we keep interrupting you, but did I hear you say that for the exceeds, it has to exceed by 20%?
Yes.
Is that the same for the
Buffer width for, or I'm sorry, yeah, the buffer width for the type F waters must be exceeded by 20% the what is required in the rule.
So, and is it the same on the compliant and non-compliant? It has to be 20%?
So it has to be compliant and exceed. To get an exceeds rating, it has to be completely compliant.
Well, completely compliant plus 20%?
Yeah, to get exceeds.
Why? It seems kind of silly.
It's got to be completely compliant.
Well, plus 20%.
Plus 20%, yes.
But went up 10% or 5%.
Yeah, where is that coming from?
It's where the 20% came from. It was
consensus.
I inherited that. A long time ago.
I was similarly
puzzled.
Yeah.
Okay.
But a particular piece of information, whatever. It doesn't make sense to me, but I mean, it's, one could argue if you're going to describe the compliant activities, that's one way to do it. Uh-huh. But it's somewhat arbitrary.
Okay.
I guess to frame that a little bit, the it was done a long time ago. The small landowner group said, hey, some of our applicants really want to get recognized for some of the larger than the necessary buffers that they leave, and we'd like this included. So that
I have no concern about it being exceeding it, or that it's identifying that it's exceeding it. It just, I didn't understand why you'd have to be 20% beyond compliant or greater than your requirement to actually get the exceeds stamp.
Right. No, that's...
Maybe it would be helpful in context to say what the variance is to be out of compliance. I believe, if I'm not wrong, that it's plus or minus 5% for measuring distances, RMZ widths, that sort of thing.
That is correct. So
okay.
5% measurement error is allowed and still considered compliant.
It might be beneficial to put those percentages somewhat consistently in the future for exceedance. If you exceed by outside of that plus or minus 5%, then you are truly exceeding. Even if it was only one more tree outside of that plus or minus 5%, it still is exceeding the rule. And somebody has left value on the ground that is contributing to public resources and certainly did not contribute to their financial benefit. And I think it would be beneficial to look at it in the same way, both directions.
Okay. Yeah, I think you heard that pretty clearly from all of us. It just doesn't make sense why you have a 20%. It's a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting well behind. Let's keep moving next.
In Eastern Washington, did a little better than Western Washington with 74% compliant. 74% compliant and 21% minor, no majors or moderates, and 5% indeterminate. For type NPs, statewide, looking at compliance with the rule, we were looking at 1% major noncompliance, 2% moderate noncompliance, 7%. Still not quite up in the 90% level, because we had 4% that we didn't know what category non-compliance is, what it is. Statewide NS, still looks pretty good, 92% of compliance. Road activities, and this is looking at both those with no potential to deliver, those are the ones that I mentioned earlier were high and dry, and those that were compliant, that's over 90%, and then the 1% moderate, no majors, 5% minor non-compliance, 2% undetermined. Okay, the supplemental water, when the compliance crew gets out on the stream, it looks like the stream typing is not what is on the ground, not what it is classified in the FDA. We do a review called the Supplemental Water Information Form. And this slide represents the outcomes of that. And we look at the various types. Type NS, there were 84 of them in the sample. We looked at 26 of them in the SWIFT that we thought that had doubts on them. And of those, 4 were actually underclassified. Some the indeterminates are not showing on this, so it won't sum up to the number. But in the case of NPs, we reviewed 30 of those out of 89, and 21 of those 89 appeared to be underclassified. In other words, NP that had some sort of F physical on it. FRS were none were under classified. Some unmapped features, you know, those are features that there was no, that we essentially encountered in the course of the review that were not stated or noted or mapped on the application, and there were 12 of those occurring.
So just looking at your totals here, so of the 91 that you looked at from your subset of 294 that raised your flag, more than a third of them were underclassified as per the segment you looked at on the ground. Is that what I
interpret? No, there's 294 that we looked at in total.
Right.
There were 91 that we thought it was that we ought to go through the rigor of the form.
Okay.
And then of those, so there's 37 of 294 that were underclassified.
So you're assuming that 203 were okay. Is that what you're saying? Of the 294?
No.
Yeah, that's
more
a little confusing.
That.
So of the 294 that were your standard sample,
mm-hmm.
how many of them did you look at for the SWIFT?
91. We
okay,
looked
so,
at.
So of the 91, 37 were underclassified.
Right. That's true. Okay.
So that how is that not a little more than a third?
It's not a third of all the streams that were looked at.
Right, but it's a third of the ones that you did look at.
Right. Okay. That's not.
So
that's
why
not
did
total.
You not look at
the total population is just 294.
So right, but you didn't.
The sample size is 294.
Right.
There are 294 stream segments observed. Of those, 91 were questionable upon observation, so measurements were taken.
Right. Okay.
So,
yeah,
and then of the ones that measurements were taken, 37 appeared to be underclassified.
Okay.
So it does depend on what you use as the measure.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, it works
better.
If I'm not incorrect, and this, tell me if I am, this SWIFT that you're using here was not required in the FPAs or some similar process, I think, at this point in time when these were all submitted and approved. Is that?
No, it is not. It's a process used by the compliance monitoring team where we have concerns about the accuracy of the water typing on the FPA.
Okay.
Yeah,
There is a new right. process that's included in the course practice application that does require every stream to be identified and determined.
Not really a new process.
Pardon me?
Not a new process.
Well,
clarification that there is a form available to landowners to use for that purpose, and it has always been available. We're emphasizing the need for it to be used.
Yeah, and essentially then it is certainly required in every application that we submit now by the region.
The worksheet is not a required element. It is optional, but it is highly recommended.
Okay.
In any case, you have to show your work. That's the bottom line. And you can do that in different ways.
And so just to get to the heart of the question, I think that it was maybe less of a recommendation or less of a component of an approved FPA during this 2008 to 2010 approval process than it may currently be.
That's
a fair statement.
Which is also part of why that element was on our compliance action plan last year. And we're not entirely seeing the results yet because we're just getting going on implementing that. But thank you for pointing that out.
Okay.
The next slide refers to the water classification emphasis sample that we engaged last year looking at FPAs that were sampled after June 1st. And we looked at 55 waters in all. The 20 NSs, four were considered to be type F by waters by the rule. NPs, we looked at 18. Six of those had F physicals. It's in some portion of their reach. Go on down there. So that. One of the A wetlands also had F physicals, as did one of the waters that was deleted by the applicant. that was on the map, and then they said, no, it's not a water. We went out there and they said, no, it's got that physical. So we did a summary this year of haul route compliance, and the which has not been done before. And we looked at a subset of the standard sample, and we divided the compliance into no delivery, de minimis delivery, low, medium, and high levels of delivery. And in the review of this, we found that essentially 95.6% of the roads were compliant when you're looking at no delivery and de minimis combined. De minimis means that it is just a hint of siltation that's occurring into any type of water. And so that was actually better than a lot of folks expected. I wasn't really all that surprised by it.
And Walt, if I could, from reading the report, if I recall, the de minimis is actually a part of Ecology's Clean Water Act terminology, so it wasn't a new definition that was constructed for this, but...
Right. Much of the construction of this came from Department of Ecology, and we appreciate the help Ecology gave us in designing this program. They were very instrumental in that. So let's look at comparison with 2008-2009. It's the second to last slide. This is an analysis done by our statistician looking at the various different features or various different prescriptions. The only one where there was statistical difference was type NPs. Compliance in 2010-2011 was at 87%. And the previous one was at 73%, and with the p-value of 0.048, it met the significance category, and so that's the only one. The rest of them are really not statistically different. We're trying to improve this measure over time by changing our sampling strategy in the coming years, and we're essentially trying to select a higher level of each activity to be able to get better confidence in the analyzer. So the summary points, there were fewer major and moderate severity rate occurrences than in 2008-2009. But the numbers, I believe, we had two. In the previous biennium, we had 7 major and 14 moderate. And in this for riparian activities, and 2 made, and this year we had 2 major and 7 moderate. The haul routes demonstrated a high level of compliance. The road construction abandonment showed good compliance if you roll in the low potential to deliver ones in there. Western Washington type F prescriptions need some improvement, and we need improvement in classifying load gradient stream reaches. Just to talk about those, we looked at the majority of those this late last summer and fall, and what we found is that generally parts of these lower streams, the applicants were missing the width characteristic. They may have been dry at the time, but they were still had beds of 5 feet. Greater than 2 feet and gradients less than 20%. And the part of if it's part of the reach, we have to consider that part of the reach in the sample. So not all of every one of these MP and NSs had F physicals. Some of them did though. Some of them essentially had F physical all along.
Great. I know we're gonna have more questions and Darren's gonna talk a little bit about what we've done since, but I just wanted to point out that this is the biennial report. It feels a little funny because we had the biennial report brought to us last year, and so that one was a year late, so we are now on schedule with our biennial reports. However, we have implemented a procedure where we want to have the results come back because we're finding, obviously, the more we the data is very helpful for us as enforcing rules, and so we will be reporting annually on the compliance data, but we won't be doing we'll stay on the biennial report timeline. So every 2 years we'll get a report like this, but we'll be seeing the data year to year. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay. And Darren, if you want to talk about what we've been doing since then to address these issues.
Yeah, we haven't quite nailed down the details on how we're going to do the annual, but I'm envisioning some sort of summary level, a few tables provided, so that we don't get in too much of the way of the work of doing the actual measurements out in the field for the biennial. But yes, the intent is to try to get some feedback on any of this. I just wanted to point out on one of Walt's slides, I don't know if you caught this, the last slide on water typing was an emphasis sample that occurred in 2011. There was a tighter date range on that. And the original intent of that was to try to capture any effect that we might see from implementing the action plan. Obviously, from the numbers, you can tell we didn't get any effect. It's disappointing, but not real surprising, because we had just rolled out the action plan and we're just starting to incorporate that into our operations and our region performance objectives at that time. It completely overlapped with the sample period for this effort. So, not surprising, but still nonetheless demonstrates that we've got a ways to go in improvement.
But this kind of gets to a question that I had. In, if I'm understanding this correctly, so if you just, well, those are type N's that met the rule-based type F, so that was based on physicals?
It was on physicals.
In the sampling segment without evidence of a water type modification form? Exactly, okay. So when you encounter that, is there an opportunity for the compliance team or somebody to verify that there's no water type modification form? Because you didn't have it in the field, so you marked it down, but do you guys follow up with that later to see if there was a form submitted? Or
no, we looked at that in advance
See
whether there was a form submitted.
Okay, good.
We inquire with the region whether they have something on the file, because you know we're going to look at this, and then we look at the data that is in the hydro data.
Okay, and then if there's no form, are there any instances where the landowner it just didn't get submitted or some other reason that you know the water type mod was like the shock is the street signal was shock but it just didn't get submitted, or do you know of any other reasons why?
I have heard of protocols being done but not being submitted, but I think we've had one of those run across once, and I think that's been fairly recently, so that's not it would be very rare. I mean, we do a pretty thorough job of checking it out, particularly on what's the data there, inquiring of the foresters, hey, have there been any water type mods done on this prior to the submission of the application.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. So, Darren, go ahead. I know that you developed a memo for the board.
Ask how much detail you want to go into, given the time frame.
Yeah, I think maybe just hit the highlights, okay. But has that been shared with everybody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a memo in today's packet.
Those of you that were here last May, you'll recall the action plan that was discussed earlier. For those of you that were not, there was a action plan developed by the division in response to the last biennial report. We categorized a number of tasks that we thought we needed to do to improve compliance, and this is a summary of those tasks and where we are today on each one of those. And I won't go each one. You can read it. If you have questions, you can ask me now or later, give me a call or whatever you choose to do. I'll just summarize at the high level. So under water typing, as you saw from the slides, we still got a ways to go. We've completed two of the five tasks that we set out to do, and we have one more that we're just about done with. We'll probably have it done in the next month or two. And then we have two on hold that are somewhat dependent upon our IT division in helping us get some space on our website to develop an information sharing page. And we think that'll help on the modification end, not necessarily on the application approval side. But we are not able to proceed on that at this time until some resources free up in our IT division. Under riparian noncompliance, we had two activities. One's complete, and one we have not moved on, given that we've had some vacancies in the division. In particular, I'm talking about board manual work. Our board game coordinator position has been vacant for some months, and we hope to fill that soon, and we can get going on that task. Under the 20-acre exempt noncompliance, if you recall from the last biennial report, we had some concerns about the compliance rates on those applications. We've taken a few steps to try to improve that. We did not incorporate a resample into this round. We just did not have the time and the resources to fit it in this year. We will look into doing that next year. We've completed one of those tasks. Another is partially complete, and another is pending. Under road noncompliance, all those tasks are either complete or ongoing. I'd like to say that the results reflect that, but I don't think I can say that quite yet. Even though we did get some pretty good results on roads, I don't think it's necessarily due to the things that we've done related to the action plan. Under type A wetland noncompliance, we have two complete tasks. Two of the tasks are complete or ongoing, one is pending. And then under the ongoing evaluation of the program, this has been alluded to a little bit in the presentation and discussion and questions. This is an ongoing activity. Some of the things we hope to do this next round are increase our sample size on some of those activities where we have low numbers to try to get those confidence intervals a little tighter around our mean compliance ratings. Continuously improve on our efficiency and effectiveness and how we carry out this program through standardization and training, which I'll speak a little bit about here in a minute. And looking how to better align how we do compliance monitoring and how we do routine compliance out in the field in the region every day. There's a world of difference between how those two things are performed in level of effort and precision. And I haven't figured this out yet completely, but some way we've got to get those two closer together. Our foresters do not spend an entire day out on a single FDA measuring everything. Yet the compliance monitoring program does, and that's how they determine compliance. We will never be able to do that on a day-to-day basis. So somehow we've got to get those two closer together and talk to each other. We had a number of other things we wanted to do last year when we were under a little bit more financial duress than we are right today. The biggest one is our training program. We lost that a few years ago. We have a skeleton of a training program going today. And we think that will make a huge difference in not only how evenly the rules are implemented by our folks, but once we make that training available to cooperators and regulating community, their understanding of the rules will increase. So we're happy to note that we do have that back online. The department restored some of our base funding to get a training program going. We're going to start that this month. We hired the person. They're going to actually start mid-month. And we'll roll out a training program that I hope will be much bigger and better than we've had in the recent history of the program. And while that, I don't think, will make a big difference overnight, over the long term, I expect it will make a huge difference. That's a high-level summary of where we are on the action plan. A lot of these things we still have to do or are ongoing tasks, and I expect over time we will see an effect in the next rounds of the compliance monitoring. Questions?
Are there fines for people that are moderate and major non-compliance for RMZs?
The compliance monitoring program is not an enforcement program. So while we turn over the information that is found through compliance monitoring to our region, that is handled through the routine enforcement of our region forest practices staff. So it's kind of separate from compliance monitoring, but if there's something that occurred that they didn't know about, compliance monitoring stumbles across, it will be forwarded to the region. The regions will take action as dictated by the degree of noncompliance.
and how it occurred, the behavior of the operator or landowner, how cooperative they are, their past performance, a number of factors go into determining what type of enforcement action we may take.
So if somebody's found to be like a major non-compliance in one audit, are they then again automatically chosen?
No.
The next time it's all
random selection.
So they could still continue to be a major non-compliance.
I would hope not, because we would turn that over to the regents, and the regents would follow up with that particular applicant or landowner to see what happened and work with them to avoid that from happening again.
And that happens more at the routine enforcement level.
Okay.
All our foresters know their geography and their landowners, and they have levels of risk or levels of confidence in those who perform those activities and show up on site, proportionally.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Go ahead,
Rob. Well, I sent this question to you via email yesterday, and I don't know if you had a chance to get to it. That was regarding the numbers of FPAs that were approved, total numbers, and then what amount out of that were actually harvesting FPAs, if you have that data. It was getting to how you generated your sample size and so on.
Right. I did get the message. I actually responded to you, but I got a message back from the email system that didn't accept the message.
DNR's having problems with emails.
Okay. So the answer to that is it's going to take me some time to do that. I mean, and it's a fairly extensive little run through, because the way we done the sampling in the past is we essentially assign all the FPAs, the 8097, would get a random number, and then we just keep going, and as that's ranked, and we just order that random, and that's how we select the FPAs which we measure. So we really don't know as we go through that list how many have got that. So it would be a fairly long and expensive process to go through and find precisely how many of those were done. I can go through the proportions of the list of the data that I've got, but and give you a ballpark answer on that, if that would be acceptable. I just email that to you. I guess I'm not concerned, but wondering what you're trying to get at with the question.
Okay, well, we can maybe talk after during the break, and whatever answer that you can provide for that, it would be helpful to share with the board. Okay.
I can tell you is the 8973, that was the total number?
Yes.
So 8,973 applications within the sample frame period. Of those, class threes are selected randomly. And this isn't related to the work that Walt does, but typically about 70% of our application pool is class three applications. So that's just a ballpark.
So that would be road construction or harvesting typically.
Right. And there typically would need to be water associated with the FPA.
Thanks, sir.
Well, I asked this question earlier, and it was just, is there any concentration among landowners that demonstrate non-compliance?
We don't break it down by landowner yet. I guess we could once we have an accumulation of enough data. I can tell you from the data I get from WALT through the compliance monitoring program, but just from interaction from our regions, we tend to spend more time with the small landowners. They harvest less frequently. They are less familiar with the rules. And it typically takes a lot more time to get an approved application, and we often see more problems during operations. And that's not to pick on them, but it's just a fundamental, just the way it is, given the fact that they harvest so frequently. But that's anecdotal information. It doesn't come necessarily from the compliance.
Okay, robust discussion. Thank you. So we'll be looking to seeing increased rates of compliance.
Yes.
And implementation of the action plan. I know it's been an active discussion at DNR with our regions as far as their reporting to to the headquarters office as far as things that we are moving from them, so we can see that. We'll take our lunch break. I apologize for kind of keeping us late. I will get us back on schedule, fear not. And to do that, we'll reconvene at 1:15. Okay, we'll see you at 1:15.